The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Community column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God exists, why hasn't he done a better job of making himself known? Well, actually, he's done a terrific job of making himself known, and he's been interacting with people since the beginning of history. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Bob, if that's really true, there should be a record generation after generation of divine activity. I mean, how could the God of the universe interacting with this planet go unnoticed? There should be a record interaction, generation after generation. People who claim they heard God's voice, people who wrote it down. Where is the historical record of the miracles, of the speaking? Well, that you're asking an excellent question. Fortunately, there's an excellent answer. We do have it. We have exactly such a record in history, a library of documents passed down generation after generation, and eventually assembled into one volume called the Bible. Today, we continue with our series on the accuracy and credibility of Scripture. We'll get to it after we comment on a couple of news events. Welcome to our sanctuary, the sanctuary for skeptics and doubters. Doubt is not a four-letter word on this program. In fact, I have actually counted the letters, and it's a five-letter word. Go figure. I want to welcome those of you hearing us for the very first time today. I've been on KCBQ for almost 7 years, but today we break in a new time slot, 6 o'clock to 7 p.m. So welcome those who are continuing to listen and tuning us in at a new time, and welcome to the newcomers. If you turn on the radio expecting to hear Dave Stahl, he still has several programs on KCBQ. You can go to kcbq.com to check the listings, see when they play. But today, right now, you are listening to The Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. I am both a Christian apologist and a political satirist. I write for Washington Times Community, San Diego Rostra, and San Diego Newsroom. Often what I write about, I also talk about. For example, President Obama's recent speech about Afghanistan. Boy, did you love that one? Polling data revealed a sharply divided country, with those desiring to bring our troops home in a majority. Hasn't always been the case, but they've become the majority. According to a recent Pew Research poll, 56% of Americans prefer ending the war, while according to Pew, 39% support leaving our troops in Afghanistan until conditions have stabilize their words. Mixed reactions to last week's speech are certainly understandable, especially with so many sub-issues involved. The first question is an obvious one. Should our commander-in-chief be paying less attention to polls and more attention to his military commanders? On the other hand, can we stay in Afghanistan indefinitely, watching our honorable men and women put their lives on the line to prop up a fragile, unstable government whose enemies hover like vultures? And then there's also a question of motivation. How much of this timetable emanates from Obama's ideology as opposed to political calculation? That answer, to be fair, is not immediately forthcoming. Oh, I know. Certainly our president is an astute politician, but he also seems sincere, dangerously sincere, and dangerously naive in his foreign policy. Oh, he's good at sounding knowledgeable while giving a speech. But don't be taken in by polish and finesse. Let's play a few clips and then analyze them together.
For this reason, in one of the most difficult decisions that I've made as president, I ordered an additional 30,000 American troops into Afghanistan. When I announced this surge at West Point, we set clear objectives: to refocus on al-Qaeda, to reverse the Taliban's momentum, and train Afghan security forces to defend their own country. I also made it clear that our commitment would not be open-ended, and that we would begin to draw down our forces this July. Tonight, I can tell you that we are fulfilling that commitment.
Obama's reminder that he kept his promise is noteworthy. Still, truth be told, many people worry more about our president keeping his promises than breaking them.
Thanks to our extraordinary men and women in uniform, our civilian personnel, and our many coalition partners, we are meeting our goals. As a result, starting next month, we will be able to remove 10,000 of our troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and we will bring home a total of 33,000 troops by next summer, fully recovering the surge I announced at West Point. After this initial reduction, our troops will continue coming home at a steady pace as Afghan security forces move into the lead. Our mission will change from combat to support.
Announcing in advance when we are going to wind down our military presence is an interesting strategic maneuver, one probably unfamiliar to the very cadets who listened to the prequel speech a year ago. I doubt that too many West Point courses encourage such a strategy. As for bringing home 33,000 troops next summer, let's see. Next summer, 2012, something seems familiar about that year. Now, don't tell me. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Could this be Obama's way of ending the war enough to satisfy anti-war protesters, people like Code Pink who helped elect him, all the while giving himself wiggle room by still leaving other troops in Afghanistan until 2014? If the whole withdrawal scenario blows up in his face, Obama can explain to the American people. I love how it's always the American people. I'll explain to the American people why we must stay a little longer. And this explanation would take place after he secures his second and final term in office, unless some judge rules that it's unconstitutional and he takes a third term. That could happen too.
By 2014, this process of transition will be complete, and the Afghan people will be responsible for their own security.
Now, we don't need a crystal ball to guess how that's going to work out. The Taliban will be back in power faster than catnip turns your pet feline into a maniac.
We're starting this drawdown from a position of strength.
True, but what will it look like 1 year after our final set of evacuations?
Together with the Pakistanis, we have taken out more than half of al-Qaeda's leadership.
Yes, but who exactly is he talking about? The Pakistani officials may have offered some assistance, but they weren't incredibly helpful in locating the biggest fish of all, were they? True, Obama said in this same speech that we will work with the Pakistani government to root out the cancer of violent extremism, and we will insist that it keep its commitments. But one wonders how that's working out. How's that working out? Well, certain Pakistani informants did help our Central Intelligence Agency in nailing bin Laden. Several of them were arrested by Pakistan's own spy organization for their actions.
The information that we recovered from bin Laden's compound shows al-Qaeda under enormous strain.
That's wonderful news, Mr. President, wonderful news, but you still don't get it, do you? We are not at war merely with al-Qaeda. We are at war with militant Islam in all its incarnations. This includes terrorist organizations and ruthless governments alike. Perhaps you feel America has not declared war against this entire ensemble of characters, but your opinion is irrelevant. They have declared war on us, some by citing America specifically, others by condemning infidels in general. Mr. President, maybe you think these stages of withdrawal from Afghanistan will make a difference to the Muslim world, but on what basis? After all, your 2009 magical mystery apology tour didn't do a whole lot for America's standing amongst militant Muslims. Remember? Instead of pointing to verses in the Quran which command jihad, God forbid that you would do a thing like that, you offered a partial explanation for Muslim hostility. You called it the sweeping change brought by modernity and globalization, which led many Muslims to view the West as hostile to the traditions of Islam. This fun-packed address was delivered in Egypt, but today only 20% of Egyptians maintain goodwill toward the United States. Your speech produced a love for America that can barely be seen through a microscope. It was about as fruitful as the billions of dollars we poured into this same Egypt and other Middle East countries. Mr. President, before giving up on courting our enemies, you might want to offer the Taliban and other prominent extremist organizations a dozen red roses and a box of See's candy. It won't impress them, but maybe it will impress those Americans who elected you in the first place.
America will join initiatives that reconcile the Afghan people, including the Taliban. Our position on these talks is clear. They must be led by the Afghan government, and those who want to be a part of a peaceful Afghanistan must break from Al-Qaeda, abandon violence, and abide by the Afghan constitution.
This part of the speech was the most disturbing of all. After removing Taliban cutthroats and continuing to push them back for almost 10 years, now we are going to have talks with them? The idea, of course, is not new. A trial balloon went up in 2009 when the Obama administration talked about reaching out to moderate Taliban. What would be an example of moderate Taliban? Those who publicly flog a woman but only allow half the normal-sized crowd to watch? Or maybe they'll let a woman learn how to read, but they won't let her learn how to write. Or will they cut off a few fingers of a thief instead of his entire hand? Assuming Afghanistan becomes Al-Qaeda free, what on earth difference does that make if the Taliban return? Just imagine if the San Diego Zoo told you they caught and rounded up all escaped alligators but decided to leave the crocodiles free. Oh, only the crocodiles? That's a relief. Because, you know, technically there's a difference between an alligator and a crocodile. They're not exactly the same animal.
Afghan security forces have grown by over 100,000 troops. And in some provinces and municipalities, we've already begun to transition responsibility for security to the Afghan people. In the face of violence and intimidation, Afghans are fighting and dying for their country, establishing local police forces, opening markets and schools, creating new opportunities for women and girls, and trying to turn the page on decades of war.
The heroic Afghanis are to be admired, but how much of their courage and inspiration will evaporate after they feel abandoned by the very nation encouraging them to take a stand? And then, again, hanging around Afghanistan, Iraq, or any other place for the purpose of nation building puts America on a road without any turns. Yes, while some celebrate the reforms going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, we must remember that no law in either country is allowed to contradict the religion of Islam. Outside forces cannot change the ideology in a person's heart. Such transformation comes from other means, and without this change, nation building is at once a pointless waste of time and an unfair danger for our military. Now, I still like to give credit where credit is due. Despite all misgivings about Obama's appeasement, I am forced to agree with the president when he discourages nation building. But folks, keep in mind that other alternatives exist. Our choice is not limited to either nation building or impossible rules of warfare parsed by lawyers. Many will agree that American troops should not be scheduled to return home until after the war is won, but winning battles and hanging around indefinitely need not translate into equal objectives. Our original purpose was to not only defeat Al-Qaeda, but also the ruling Taliban who sheltered them. Once the Taliban were out of power, part of that mission was accomplished. Killing or capturing just as many Al-Qaeda members and dislodged Taliban resistors as possible is a necessary follow-up. This must include shooting even through human shields. I know that sounds horrible, but the alternative is that innocent soldiers are dying. And I don't know, if a country's going to go and if these cowards are going to hide behind innocent people, well, there's a point where that nation just has to rise up themselves and say, we won't allow this anymore. Neither should we be shy about taking out those who fire upon us from mosques. And then, instead of restructuring the government, we could say, okay, look, the Taliban have been removed from power and Al-Qaeda is gone. You now have a level playing field. Again, this is your country. If you want to be a democracy or live under Muslim law or hold to something in between, the choice is yours. But know this, if your nation ever again harbors terrorists bent upon destroying the United States, we'll be back. If we can say that without sounding too much like the former governor of California, it might just work. Even then, the war against militant Islam will not be over. Only one chapter. We need a commander-in-chief who understands this, who understands not only Afghanistan, but the other Islamic threats in Iraq, Syria, and all over the more conventional Middle East.
When Bob Siegel says President Obama doesn't understand the Middle East, he doesn't mean to imply that he knows absolutely nothing about the Middle East.
Thank you, Dan. We always appreciate the special assistance of Disclaimer Dan.
Actually, President Obama is aware that there is a whole side of the world called the East, and he does know that the Middle East is in the middle of it.
Meanwhile, there doesn't seem to be much authentic understanding of what is at stake when we talk about the whole same-sex marriage issue. The state of New York has voted on gay marriage. Actually, the people have not. We always hear that the people have spoken. People of New York have spoken. No, it's their legislature that's spoken. Now, sometimes citizens do put it to a vote, like in California, but a lot of times that doesn't make a difference either. In California, the will of the people was turned down by a judge, making us wonder if we're living under a democracy or a republic or an oligarchy-style dictatorship. That's a fair question when the subject of civil rights comes up. You're saying, but Bob, isn't it important to speak against hate? Those who are against gay marriage are filled with hate, aren't they? Okay. Now, if you're thinking that, I know you're saying that sincerely. With all due respect, that's quite a sweeping generalization. Have you met and conversed with every single person opposed to gay marriage? Have you allowed them to speak for themselves? Or are you letting others filter and restate their opinions? And how exactly are you defining hate? I respect your desire to be loving, but please be careful. Stop, take a deep breath, and notice the subtlety of what is going on. Otherwise, you may find yourself guilty of the same kinds of bigotry you claim to be against. You're thinking, but Bob, disapproving of homosexuality is like disapproving of an entire race because gay people are born that way. Well, I know a lot of African-Americans who find that insulting. In fact, African-Americans came out in record numbers and voted for Proposition 8 in California because they didn't see it that way. Actually, nothing of the sort has ever been proven as far as gay people are born. And I'll get to that later on the program. But for now, even if you disagree, viewing sexuality as different than race or skin color isn't really that far of a stretch, is it? To use some common terms, can you yourself show compassion and tolerance for people who have a view of homosexuality contrary to your own? But Bob, the rest of us are not affected by gay people getting married. Yeah, that's the $50 million challenge thrown at conservatives these days. How exactly does it hurt your own marriage or your own family if two gay people get married? Now, on its surface, this would seem to be a fair question. It would. Does another person's marriage have any direct connection to your own? Of course not. But I think we are missing a much bigger point. As Americans, you see, our lives, our marriages, our families do not exist in isolation. Folks, we are profoundly influenced by the direction of society as a whole. As a pastor, I have counseled many gays, and I am sympathetic to their plight. Of course I can understand their desire to be married. Of course I can understand that they want to be happy like everyone else. At the same time, I would be lying if I said that gay marriage does not affect the rest of us. The truth is, one can list many such effects, and I'm going to do so right now. First of all, there's the effect on your child. Even if your children live in a stable, two-parent, heterosexual home, you are only one of many influences in your child's life. Homosexuality is being presented today as an alternative lifestyle, even at the kindergarten level in some places, some states. Books such as Heather Has Two Mommies are being read to your school, or at least are on the school reading list. In fact, a recent California ruling now forbids the words father or mother in public schools out of respect for gay and transgender families. The latest bill coming out of Sacramento will force school teachers to teach about gay heroes throughout history, not merely a hero who happens to be gay, that would be fine, but people who make strides for the gay movement, such as Harvey Milk. I pity the teacher who tries to teach a different view than that, a view that says maybe homosexuality isn't right, where would the freedom of speech be? And it's also against the law for any government institution in California to speak negatively of gays. Did you know that? So a lot of this stuff was going on already, but legalization of gay marriage is going to give the militant gay agenda even more teeth. Now, I do draw a distinction between the militant gay activists and most homosexuals who probably just want to be left alone and live their lives in peace. I do. I have a lot of compassion for one group of people. But some of these squeaky wheels getting the grease, there's a battle on our hands because it's becoming a freedom of speech issue. Please do not try to tell me that these developments will not be affecting your child directly. When it's happening in school, your tax dollars are paying for it. So what about your rights? We're always talking about equal rights. Well, the rights have got to be good for everybody. So that's the effect on your children, but there's also the effect on other people's children. You should be concerned about that too. For years, we have admitted as a society that children are better off in a two-parent home. Yes, of course, there are loving single parents who have done a wonderful job. Let me say that again. I don't want to be misstated. There are loving, very compassionate, very excellent single parents who have done a wonderful job, okay? And yes, of course, there are many unhealthy, dysfunctional two-parent families, but people pointing out exceptions to the rule ignores this giant rule staring us in the face. Ideally, wouldn't we agree, children need a healthy father and a healthy mother. They need both. If they can't get both, then we take care of them the best we can. But they need both, ideally, because men and women are different. And each one has something different to offer in a child's upbringing. We used to feel free to admit this rather obvious truth, but we have gotten so used to rolling over and playing dead for the militant gay activists, and we now try to shove truth under the rug. The more children are raised by fathers and mothers together, the better we will all be as a society. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. Isn't it interesting how many self-described liberals insist we need diversity of genders on the Supreme Court because women will bring a different perspective? And yet when these same people are asked about males and females as role models for children, oh, they suddenly switch gears and talk out of both sides of their mouth. Studies on ancient Rome and other cultures show that when the family breaks down, the entire country breaks down. So once again, I would say that gay marriage has a rather large influence upon our joint future as Americans. And here to tell you all about it is our own Smiley Miley.
Hey, kids. Do you know what makes America such a great country? Family. That's right, family. Each and every one of you belongs to a family, even if you don't like your family very much. And families are as American as apple pie, baseball, and hot dogs. Of course, baseball is a chauvinistic sport because women don't play in the World Series, and apple pie has too much sugar and is not as good for you as carrot cake or quiche. And hot dogs are not very good for you either, unless you call them Frankfurters, and remember that the Frankfurter is really a German food. German food is good to eat because Germany is a different culture, and anything from a culture different than our culture is always good, even if Germany is a Western culture, and therefore not as good of a culture as a third world culture. But back to families. Just as there are different kinds of cultures, there are different kinds of families. Some of you have mommies and daddies who love you. Some of you have sisters and brothers who hate you. Some of you have grandmas and grandpas who watch you for the weekend when mommies and daddies need a break and want to get away from you. These kinds of families are familiar. But did you know that new kinds of families are forming these days? That's right, brand new families. And some of these families are more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Sooner or later, one of your little playmates will tell you that instead of a mommy and a daddy, they have two mommies or two daddies. This may look unusual, especially if you see the two mommies kissing or the two daddies cuddling on the couch while watching a football game. But even though these new families look unusual, they are actually very, very normal. Anyone who thinks two mommies are not as good as a mommy and a daddy is a fascist. Can you spell fascist? Fascist begins with an F. And an F is what you will get as a grade if you disagree with your teachers when they teach you that two mommies are normal. But it's not just a matter of spelling the word. Do you know what a fascist is? A fascist is one who believes in nasty dictators, or nasty kings, or nasty generals. These nasty rulers tell people what to do, and tell people what to think, and those who don't obey the rulers go to jail. Do you like jail? Then don't be a fascist. Now, some of you are wondering, what if I become a fascist by accident? After all, I didn't know that two ladies kissing was normal. Nobody told me that before. Don't worry. At least you heard about it today, and you heard about it in time. And we'll continue helping you each and every day by telling you what to do and telling you what to think about mommies and daddies. Someday this won't be a problem anymore. Someday it will be against the law to call something abnormal. And once we arrest those who break this law, we will keep ourselves from becoming a fascist country and remain the good old-fashioned American country we've always been. Because once again, family is as American as apple pie, hot dogs, and, well, you get the idea. That's all, kids. Have fun with your families.
You don't have to go along with all of this. You can have a mind of your own. You can have some courage. Even if people try to shut you up by using words like homophobe or phrases like hate speech, words used only by people who do not know how to defend their position with rational arguments, you don't have to be intimidated. You can follow the advice of that pop singer favorite, Mama Cass. I don't think she ever talked about gay marriage, but she did talk a lot about making your own kind of music.
Nobody can tell you there's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, cause it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you've gotta make your own kind of music. Sing your own special song. Make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. You're gonna be nowhere. Take my hand.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Back to our program. Now, during the opening monologue, I did mention that later on in the show, I was going to talk about this whole phenomenon that people are born with same-sex tendencies. And of course, a long-winded talk show host like me never quite knows how long the show's going to go on. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about that next week, because if I don't disappoint you who thought you were going to hear that this week and put it off till next week, I'm going to disappoint other people in my audience whom I teased at the top of the show, where I said I was going to finish our discussion in the Bible. We spent the last 2 weeks talking about the Bible. I don't know if we'll finish that today either, but I did promise you I'd move on with it. And what kind of guy would I be if I didn't do what I say? This has got to be a face you can trust. Now, I always like to do this. Stare into your radio right now. Look at your radio. Tell me now, is this a face you can trust? Don't go to my website and look at my real face. You might not trust that one anyway. Last week, among other things, and you can go to my website, bobsiegel.net, and hear 2 full hours of talk about the Bible where we gave all kinds of reasons. It's archaeology and corroboration with other history, et cetera, fulfilled prophecies. But I began at the end of the show last week talking about the testimony of the Bible outside of the New Testament. I mentioned last time that people say, well, the Gospels are not trustworthy because they were written by people who knew Jesus. Well, that wasn't true of Luke. I mentioned last week that Luke was an actual historian who went out, sponsored by a Roman dignitary named Theophilus, and interviewed people in the land of Israel. But yes, when we read the Gospel of Mark, Mark was a scribe for Peter, so that's really the Gospel of Peter. Matthew and John, of course, were disciples. But I talked about the fact that people were saying, well, you know, if Jesus really did miracles or really rose from the dead, we need the testimony of people that didn't know him that well. And I said we would not put anything else in history through that kind of scrutiny. I gave an example, which is given in a book about the New Testament by the brilliant Bible scholar F.F. Bruce, and I shared this example last week, that Winston Churchill, there's a guy named William Winston, who's also a great Bible scholar. And that's probably why I started mistaking the word Winston for William. I mean, my gaffes are well thought out gaffes. They're not dumb gaffes like everybody says. Oh, actually, I make the stupidest gaffes in the world, but not so stupid that I'm going to get off on any more of a tangent. I'm going to get back to Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England. He wrote a book about the Second World War. Now, who believes Winston Churchill had an unbiased view of World War II? But the other side of the question is not always asked as often. What historian, what World War II buff in his right mind, would not be interested in a book about World War II written by Winston Churchill? So we've got to give that same standard to the Bible. Show me a person that talked about Jesus and mentioned that Jesus did miracles, verified that Jesus actually lived, but the people that knew him, ate with him, slept with him, followed him around for 3 years, they don't count. That's nonsense. We would not hold anything up to that kind of scrutiny. But then I went on and said, having said that, there is a group of people, and as you know, when Jesus Christ came to Israel, there was a big split in Israel. People always think of Christianity as an anti-Jewish thing. It's a very Jewish thing, actually, because there's this big split in Israel. And the people that chose to follow Jesus eventually became known as followers of the Messiah. And the Greek translation of Messiah is Christos. The English transliteration is Christ. So we call them Christians. But that just means followers of the Messiah. The Jewish religious leaders were not too thrilled with Jesus, however, although many of them converted later on, too. We read the beginning of the book of Acts, and even later on in the book of Acts, when we get to around the middle of it, we see that a lot of the priesthood, a lot of the rabbis did give their life to Jesus. The Apostle Paul had been a rabbi. But the ones who, as time went on, held on to their hostility for Jesus, called him a sorcerer and an apostate. An apostate was a blasphemer. Of course, they called him an apostate because Jesus had claimed to actually be God incarnate. But I mentioned last week that it's very intriguing that they called him a sorcerer. Now, that's not a flattering view of Jesus, but that's what some of my skeptical friends want to hear. I don't want to just see from history, they say the guys that liked Jesus. I want to hear from the guys that didn't like him. Okay, here's people that didn't like him, and they called him a sorcerer. Why did they call him a sorcerer? Because they couldn't deny that he did miracles, but they wanted to attribute an evil source to it, the source of Satan. That's our review from last week. I promise we'll move forward when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Okay, I told you that I finished my review and I was ready to move on. Actually, there was a little more that I still need to review. Because right before our show ended last week, I was reading to you from the ancient historian Josephus. Now, Josephus was a contemporary of some of the apostles born not long after Jesus. He's a historian from the days of the New Testament. We know for a fact that Josephus was not a Christian. And in his book called The Antiquities of the Jews, book 18 and chapter 3, he says this about Jesus, and I just barely had time to read it last time, so we'll critique it this time. He says, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day." Okay, now, you would think you were reading that out of the New Testament, wouldn't you? Now, to some of you, this is going to sound like a mirage. I loved Jerry Seinfeld. He related handicapped parking places to mirages. He says, you're driving through the parking lot, and everything's taken, and it's such a busy day, and you can't find a space, and suddenly you see a space, and it's right there, and it's not even there. It's close, and it's by the door, and you don't know how you missed it, and it's for handicapped, and you can't park there. Okay, well, this is going to sound like a mirage to some people as well, because isn't this what skeptics are always asking for? If Jesus was a real historical figure, then we should see something outside of the New Testament. Now, I've proven, or at least given you incredible evidence the last couple of weeks, that the New Testament collection of documents themselves are very historical. But just for you guys that don't find that part convincing enough, here's something that clinches it. This is somebody who wasn't even a Christian. He's acknowledging that Jesus lived, that he was executed under Pontius Pilate, that he did miracles, and that he rose from the dead. He's actually taken kind of a disinterest in Jesus. This is just one of two short paragraphs about Jesus that Josephus writes. The other one's even shorter than this. And some people say, well, if it was so incredible, why wouldn't he have spent more time talking about him? Oh, because he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't a Christian. In those days, and Josephus had been a Jewish rabbi at one time, they believed in resurrection. So this guy doesn't have a problem with resurrections or miracles, but that doesn't mean he's going to go following this person and calling this person God. What he was writing, what we see detail about, is we see a comprehensive discussion of the reign of Pontius Pilate. And of course, no discussion of Pontius Pilate would fit or make sense if he didn't put in one of the more controversial things Pilate did by executing this man who split the nation. And so Josephus knew that. He was aware of that. So this just seems incredible. So what's the response to this? Do all the atheist websites admit this? No, what they do is they say, oh, that's a forgery. Christians put that in. And one of the reasons I say that is because Josephus comes to us as a copy. We have copies. The original manuscripts of Josephus do not exist. Well, I mentioned last week the original manuscripts of anything from that era do not exist because in those days you couldn't save things on your hard drive and you had to copy things. We have copies of Josephus. Once papyri became superseded by vellum, the animal skin, then by the time they started copying things on that, they could last. But of course, if things were copied, then people say, oh, well, probably as time went on, the Roman Empire kind of became subtly taken over by the monks and the Christians. So they just went in and they changed that. Well, if they were going to go in and change that, why didn't they just write a whole book about Jesus and pretend that Josephus wrote that? Why did they limit it? Well, what people do here, and I want you to catch this because I call this circular reasoning. And my skeptical atheist friends, and I do respect them, but they're always the ones telling Christians not to get into circular reasoning. You're just following that by faith. Well, as I've told you, I'm not following this by faith. I'm following this because of facts. But they'll say that. They say, don't get involved in circular reasoning. Don't say you believe it just because the Bible says so. Who wrote the Bible? Well, who did write the Bible? That's what we've been talking about. Can the Bible be defended? Good question. That's what we've been talking about. But it works both ways, my friends. It works both ways. If we should be rational and we should not be involved in circular reasoning, you've got to do the same thing. So here's the circular reasoning. I begin with my skeptical friend. He says, just show me somebody, just show me at least one person other than Christians, other than actual Christians, one historian who wasn't a Christian who claims Jesus rose from the dead, and then maybe I'll accept it. I say, okay, Josephus. And then they go, oh, well, we know that Josephus didn't really write that. But look, Jack, it's there in every extant manuscript of Josephus. Bottom line, it's there. It's there right in the archives of Pontius Pilate. It's there right where it should be. It's there. If somebody wants to claim that a Christian went in and changed it into an interpolation, the burden of proof is on them. And we have no testimony from anything in archaeology, no testimony from anything in history. There's nothing objective from the outside which tells us that Josephus didn't write this. Bible scholars and archaeologists and historians use Josephus all the time. Have you ever read a commentary? Not just Christian commentaries, Jewish commentaries. They're very indebted to men like Josephus, men like Philo, men like others. We can't change the rules and say because he's suddenly talking about Jesus, he couldn't be saying this. So if there's no objective reason, if there's no reason outside of their own subjectivity, then where are they getting these reasons? Well, they're getting it from their subjectivity. It's an opinion. First of all, they're saying, well, the reason that we know that Josephus couldn't have really written this is because we know Josephus was not a Christian. And I'm going, well, okay, so far I'm with you. You asked me for a source by somebody who wasn't a Christian, didn't you? Yeah, but then Josephus pretty clearly here believes Jesus rose from the dead. Says he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophet said foretold. Well, anybody that believes Jesus rose from the dead must be a Christian. So Josephus could not have really written that because he wasn't a Christian. Do you see the circular reasoning? If Jesus really rose from the dead, if he really rose from the dead, how could that have escaped the notice of history? Somebody other than a disciple, somebody other than a Christian must have noticed, must have written it down. Yeah, somebody did. Josephus, oh, well, he doesn't count. Why not? Well, because he claims Jesus rose from the dead. But friend, you just asked me for somebody who wasn't a Christian who claimed he rose from the dead. I just gave you exactly what you wanted. Now you want to have your cake and eat it too. This is called circular reasoning. On the other hand, isn't that a fair question? You can track their logic somewhat. They're saying, well, once he knew Christ rose from the dead, he would have become a Christian, wouldn't he? Not necessarily. Again, Josephus was a Pharisee. He could have believed that Jesus was a prophet who rose from the dead without blinking an eyebrow, without feeling the need to personally follow him, without calling himself a Christian. Yeah, but Bob, he also called him Jesus the Christ. And you said yourself, Christ means Messiah. So why would Josephus call him the Christ if Josephus wasn't a Christian? Good question. Good answer coming up. To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Siegel Show. Okay, if Josephus was a non-Christian historian, why would he call Jesus the Christ? You need to remember that Jesus was a very common name in those days. It's still a common name in many Latin American countries today. But in ancient Israel, it was a very common name. I own a copy of the complete works of Josephus, and there's something like 14 different Jesuses that he talks about. By calling him Jesus, who was called Christ, he's merely identifying which Jesus he's talking about. That would not obligate him to say that he believes it. Now, what's interesting is, whereas some people dispute this, there's a passage that hardly anybody disputes that's written by the Roman historian Tacitus. He's somebody that I want to talk about a little bit, too, in a few minutes. And nobody's questioning his authenticity. I mean, nobody of any real scholarship, no history person that's taken seriously. No ancient historian who really knows their stuff. And he calls him Christus too, just identifying the Christian movement. So that's not really a problem. So there are two of the three objections we've eliminated. See, people say, well, if he knew Jesus rose from the dead, he would have had to have become a Christian. That's baloney. I interviewed radio talk show host Michael Medved on my show a few years ago. It was a great honor to have him come on. And he's very kind to Christianity. In fact, I think he defends evangelical Christianity better than a lot of evangelical Christians defend it. But he said he believed Jesus was a prophet that God sent to the Gentiles. That's a much more generous view of Jesus than a lot of my Jewish friends will give. But I asked him if he believed Jesus rose from the dead, and he said, well, I wasn't there, which I appreciated that honest answer. But he went on to say that even if he was convinced Jesus did rise from the dead, that wouldn't obligate him to become a Christian, because as a Jew, he believes in resurrections. What's interesting is that's a kind of a modern-day way of interpreting the way Josephus would have looked at it. Now, there's one more part of this passage that people jump on, and it says, he appeared to them alive at the third day as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. No, that's not the part. It's earlier. Let me go back. Okay, yes, it's at the top. Now, about this time, there was Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. Okay, that's the phrase they key in on. If it be lawful to call him a man. Some people think that they're hinting at the divinity. So even if somebody wants to say, okay, Bob, maybe an ancient Jew wouldn't follow Jesus and become a Christian just because he rose from the dead or just because he did miracles, and maybe Christ. And remember, again, Josephus is writing for a Roman audience, not a Jewish audience. So the term Christ doesn't mean as much to the Romans. That would have meant something to the Jews, but he's writing to a Roman audience. So you say, Bob, I'm with you so far, but if Josephus is saying that Jesus was God, only a Christian believes Jesus was God. Yeah, but my point is, he doesn't actually say that. People are kind of interpreting it that way. If it be lawful to call him a man. In those days, it was commonly believed, and there were stories in the Old Testament, that angels could become people, or not really become people, but take on like an incarnation. There are times where people met all over the Old Testament, where people ran into strangers and people that talked to them. They thought it was a prophet at first, found out it was an angel. So maybe Josephus thought Jesus was an angel. And actually, it was very Jewish to give those kinds of statements. It was very poetic. I've talked about this before on the show, these exaggerated poetic statements. If it even be lawful to call him a man, kind of like, he was such a great man, can we even call him a man? So what I'm saying is there's all kinds of reasons Josephus might have said that. Doesn't obligate him to be a Christian. The good news, not that it wouldn't have been good news for Josephus personally to have become a Christian, that might have been very good for his soul, but the good news historically is that since we know the man wasn't a Christian, yet we have a non-Christian contemporary of the New Testament verifying Jesus. Now, you might ask me, how do we know for a fact that he wasn't a Christian? Well, it's easy. Josephus believed the Roman Emperor Vespasian was the Messiah. Boy, was he wrong about that, but at least we know from that he didn't believe that Jesus was. Now, there's another document. I've kind of saved the best for last. This is going to sound like one of those good news, bad news things. This one was called the Acts of Pilate. Pontius Pilate made a record, which all Judean governors and anybody in a Roman province would make. But he found the events, and we read about a lot of these events, particularly at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. We read about the earthquake and it turning dark and people coming back and the Roman soldiers telling the Sanhedrin that some angel came and rolled the boulder away. And they're saying, well, don't go tell the people that story. Tell them that the disciples came by night and stole the body. Well, of course, Matthew, who wrote the Gospel of Matthew, was around to watch a lot of stuff. He wasn't around for those things at the end. Did you ever wonder where that material might have come from? Evidently, it came from not Josephus, but Pontius Pilate himself. There was a letter that he wrote to Emperor Tiberius. He was so overwhelmed and compelled by these miraculous events surrounding the passion, death, and the resurrection of Christ that he actually became a Christian. And his letter was so convincing to Emperor Tiberius that Emperor Tiberius went to the Roman Senate and asked them to classify Jesus as a god. The Roman Senate decided not to do it. This is an incredible source, right? Well, I told you it'd be a good news, bad news thing. What's the bad news? Well, there is a problem, and it's a significant one. The Acts of Pilate does not exist today. Or let me put it this way. It's either been destroyed or it's lost, waiting to perhaps be discovered someday, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the Rosetta Stone. But we do not have this document. Well, then why am I referring to it? Because there are all kinds of documents from the ancient world that have been destroyed. How do we know that they exist? Because other documents talk about them. There are four documents that talk about the Acts of Pilate. One of them, I referred to him already, Tacitus, writing about the great fire in Rome in 64 AD, because Emperor Nero was blaming the fire on Christians. There's rumors that Nero might have started that fire himself. We don't know for sure if he did. We do know that he blamed it on Christians and made them a scapegoat. And a lot of the Romans in those days didn't take much interest in Christianity until Christians started disobeying them, refusing to worship their gods, refusing to worship the emperor, getting blamed for the fire. So for the first time in his life, when it makes police news, which is when we would expect it, Tacitus goes and starts investigating Christianity, and he finds that there was a person named Jesus Christ who was executed under Pilate. Well, where would he have gotten that information? From the Roman Imperial Archives. We have a letter that has survived talking about what a reputed historian Tacitus was, that people knew that this was a man who, if he said it, it was true because he would have verified it. Now, there was another person, and this takes us to the second century, about 150 AD. This person's name was Antoninus Pius. Antoninus Pius was one of the first Christian apologists, people who were defending Christianity against the Roman emperors. Actually, Antoninus Pius was the Roman emperor at that time. The person who defended himself, the person who was the Christian apologist, was Justin Martyr. And he wrote a book to Antoninus Pius talking about the miracles associated with the last days of Jesus. And he said, if you have any doubt about these things, all you have to do is consult the Acts of Pilate. He used that book by name. Okay, well, if you use that book by name, then he must have been awfully confident that that book existed. That would be a pretty stupid thing to say to a Roman emperor who could go check the Roman archives at any time. There were two other sources that identified the Acts of Pilate. I'll get to them next week. Now, right now, some of you are saying, Bob, if the Acts of Pilate doesn't exist, then we can't trust it. Really? Do you trust Socrates? Do you believe that Socrates lived? Do you believe Socrates taught? If Socrates ever wrote anything, We know it only because people like Plato and Xenophon recorded his words. We accept things from history on that basis all the time, my friends, all the time. We will see you next week on The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.